I'm not going to address the same point as everybody else. I'm still on set, but South Evans, the tribunal is illegal, and an attack on sovereignty signals to the world what can happen to you if you resist the New World Order. I'm going to make my remarks about my personal experience of the, not only peripherally this tribunal in The Hague here, but mainly about my experience of the Rwanda tribunal, which is the sister tribunal to The Hague tribunal, and up until last year had the same, shared the same prosecutor. And Mr. Clarkin will echo everything I said to you. He's done a trial there. Or what is called, it's supposed to be a trial. The experience of most lawyers, in fact, lawyers without exception of these tribunals, is one of shock, depression, dismay, anger, and sometimes almost going insane, because these aren't trials, they are inquisitorial proceedings in which there's only one objective, and that is to put the accused in prison and use them as an example to their home peoples. The trials themselves are something to see if you've ever, not only if you've all watched the Milosevic trial, which is an egregious example of what can happen, but at the Rwanda tribunal, perhaps it's even worse, because in that instance, the attackers of the three people that took apart Rwanda are a proxy force called the Rwandan Patriotic Front, the RPF, backed by England and the United States and its allies. They have now, through several of their officers, have let the regime admit that they have killed in 12 weeks 2 million Hutus. There are two groups of two of the minority who attacked. And the existing government at that time, who is now all in prison, the Hutu government. The genocide didn't happen, except insofar as the invading army killed 2 million Hutus in those 12 weeks. And yet not one member of that invading army has been charged. Not one member of the American, Canadian, Belgian, or other allied countries who are involved in that war have been charged. Not one member of the United Nations military forces in Rwanda to maintain peace or transition government was formed, and who were involved in overthrowing the regime have been charged. So we have an exactly parallel situation to what happened in Yugoslavia, where Yugoslavia was targeted in Eastern Europe. At the same time, the U.S. and Britain targeted Rwanda to take control of Central Africa. And they used the same techniques, same strategies, broke up the country, caused all sorts of trouble inside the country, and demonized the existing regime as criminals, abusing human rights and so on. Now, in these trials, you don't have indictments with specific charges which the accused know they're facing. The indictments are multiple. They continually change. In my case, now we've had three indictments. The last one issued 1 month before the trial began. So up until after 4 years of doing this case, I still do not know what the charges are against my client, who is the head of the National Police there. And there have been cases in which indictments, in which people have been convicted of crimes not included in the indictments. We are told that we are allowed to defend these people and we're given resources, but we're not. Many times lawyers are not paid for months, sometimes up to a year. I haven't been paid now for over a year, except my expenses. I've made no money. Many lawyers are the same. We only are allowed part-time investigators, part-time legal assistants. Investigators have been arrested. We've had several cases in which our investigators, many of them from Rwanda, have been arrested and charged with war crimes themselves in order to sabotage our defense. Investigators have been accused of war crimes and their contracts suspended but never charged. And last week, an investigator was found poisoned in a hotel room in Malawi. And I know this man, he was Alois He worked on two cases there. Now, on a mission in Malawi, he was found poisoned, and we know who did it. Not only was he poisoned, several other investigators working for lawyers on the so-called Military One trial, which is their Milosevic trial, their big trial. Several other investigators have been threatened when they've gone to do investigations in Rwanda. All the witnesses they've seen have been picked up by the military police and intelligence services in Rwanda and detained and threatened. And now we have investigators who've fled to France and seek refugee status because they're afraid they even work or live in Africa anymore. Lawyers have been threatened. I was threatened by two ministers of the RPF government and told them that if I didn't keep my mouth shut, that I had a very dim future. So you can't defend people under those circumstances. You can't prepare a defense. Not only are lawyers not paid, which is perhaps something we have to suffer, but we don't get any money to do investigations. You have to apply every time you want to send an investigator to a different country to speak for a witness, many of them are in Europe, you have to apply for permission. And often they say, no, we're not going to pay for that trip, without any reason. Or they'll approve a trip, then cancel it. Lawyers, there's no right to counsel. They say there's a right to counsel, but for instance, I was talking to Ramsey earlier. If I'm an accused and I would like Ramsey to be my lawyer, he first has to be put on the list, and that's a process which they have to approve. And they resist certain lawyers, those they know will fight them. And then, if you do get on the list, and the accused, I ask for Ramsey, they tell me to give three names to them, and they will give me the third name on the list. If Ramsey's first, they won't give me Ramsey, give me somebody else. Or if they don't like anybody on that list, they'll say, we don't like this, let's give this another list. Until they get someone they like, and then that's who I'll get. There have been cases where accused have selected counsel from different countries, and they had deliberately given them counsel they never even had to be on the list in order to prevent certain counsel from being representing these people. And this occurs at the ICTY as well. The trials are impossible because there's no disclosure to speak of. All the witnesses at the ICTY are testifying under secret names, and these code names are ostensibly to protect these witnesses from retribution by the accused. How can President Milosevic take retribution against some witness who appears for prosecution? He's got no power. And the same with the entire Hutu leadership in prison. They have no power to affect anything inside Rwanda. The military dictatorships exist there now. And yet they insist on not telling us who these witnesses are until a few days before they appear. And that process is that secret witness aspect is put in place in order to dramatize that these people are scary people. They want the world to think that these people, President Milosevic, these Hutus, are dangerous people even while they're in prison. That's how bad they are. So the witnesses can't testify openly under their real names because they could be assassinated or murdered in the this way. None is true. But the whole thing is theater. It's all about theater. So, the practical effect, though, is that when they come to testify, we have no idea who they are. We can't go and check their backgrounds to see if they actually were in the places they say they were to see the things they say they saw. It turns out that most of the prisoners, as of the ICTY, witnesses, many of them are people, small people, peasants, drivers, shop assistants, people who somehow overhear conversations between generals and leaders. In the Rwanda situation, I'd say 80% of the witnesses are prisoners from the jails in Rwanda. Most of them picked up on unspecified charges, held for years at a time. We had one guy 2 days ago tell us that he'd been picked up in 1997 at 19 years of age, held on charges he was never told about. He tried to confess to some charges. They wouldn't let him. He's still being held in prison in a cell 5 by 7 meters with 120 people for the last 7 years. And they've all done deals in order to get out. And they've all been scripted. He even told us that the investigators had told him what to say at the hearings. And I'm sure this is what goes on at the ICTY. Most of the witnesses are scripted. There are three cases in the Rwanda tribunal which witnesses have been brave enough to come and say that all the witnesses in this trial I'm testifying in, Mr. Judge, all of us have been told what to say. All of us have been given scripts, and we were told to say this, otherwise we'd be shot. There's a famous one in the media trial. Now, these people have been sent back to Rwanda, and we don't know what's happened to them. But that's probably what's happening at the ICTY. Most of the witnesses who were small people are being forced to testify to scripts, because if you examine their testimonies, they know things they couldn't possibly know. They say things they saw things they couldn't possibly have seen. Then you get a situation where you can't cross-examine. The judges don't want us to discuss the actual context of the wars involved. Mr. Milosevic can't discuss NATO actions. He's not allowed to discuss what Clinton did and what everybody else did. That's not relevant. In the Rwanda tribunal, you can't discuss what the RPF did, what the UN did. That's not relevant. So the enemy is never considered. There's a war, but the enemy forces are never discussed, never allowed to be mentioned. They're just ghosts on the wall, shadows. The use of hearsay is infamous. Most of the witnesses come in and say, I don't know anything myself, but I heard from X, he told me that Zed told them this. And that's the basis for most of the convictions. It's all double, triple, and quadruple hearsay. Very few witnesses who come to this tribunal have had direct observations of what they say they saw. As with Mr. Milosevic, there's not been one scintilla of evidence that the crimes they say were committed even existed. The Rwanda tribunal, there's not one scintilla of evidence yet. After 8 years, it was a plan to commit genocide. Not one. Not one document, not one telephone call, not one fax or communicator order, nothing. And yet these trials go on. One famous example happened in September. And this, I think, shows you exactly what's going on in both these tribunals. As you may remember, in the 1994 so-called genocide in Rwanda, the first day after the president's plane is shot down, we now know by the RPF and other forces, 10, or maybe 13 Belgian soldiers were killed at the military base. They were picked up at a certain place, taken to a military base by the Rwandan army, and mutant soldiers there attacked them and killed them. One of the theses is that the government planned to kill Belgian soldiers in order to force a Belgian contingent of the UN forces to leave. So the UN would leave the country, and therefore they could go ahead with their plan to commit genocide. This whole theory falls apart, though, if there was no plan to kill Belgian soldiers. The prosecution has charged two officers in my trial with planning to kill these Belgian soldiers. And they bring in a corporal who was at their camp and said, I saw them encourage the soldiers to kill these Belgians. The man was never there. He was never at that camp. His story is completely fabricated. But more egregious than that is that the prosecution gave us a disclosure on a CD-ROM, which they had never read, but which we did. In that CD-ROM is the entire UN force report on the death of those soldiers. And in that report, they speak to UN military observers who were based at that camp, saw the Belgians arrive, and saw them being attacked. The UN military observers and some UN Ghanaian soldiers who were there, state that when mutinous soldiers who thought the Belgians shot down the plane, and it's probably true, they helped shoot down the plane, were so angry that they killed their president, attacked these soldiers, all the senior officers at that military base tried to stop that attack. They came and tried to stop their men from killing these Belgians. The soldiers turned their guns on their own officers and forced them to back off. So the UN has in its hands information from UN officers, one's a captain, which completely exonerate these soldiers from the crime for which they're held now for 5 years in prison. They will never bring those UN soldiers, to testify. They will never alert the judges to the fact that these guys are the complete defense. And they lay these charges knowing that they're not guilty of them. And they have to lay that charge because if they don't, the entire thesis that there was a plan to commit genocide falls apart. If they didn't want to kill Belgians, that means that they didn't want to drive the Belgians out. If they didn't want to drive the Belgians out, the UN forces didn't have to go. Therefore, they couldn't fit the plan into the genocide. So they continue this absurd logic of going ahead with charges they know not to be true in order to, in the eyes of the public, condemn this whole government. We gave the judges the statements by the UN soldiers who were at that camp and saw what really happened. The judges looked at it and then just thrust it aside and said it wasn't relevant. So you ask yourself, can these men get a fair trial? No. Can they get a fair trial? Can President Milosevic get a fair trial if he's not allowed to present what really happened in the Balkans in the 90s? No. Can the world ever know if he's guilty or not guilty if he's not allowed to discuss history, what really happened? Can these men in Rwanda do that if they're not allowed to discuss what really happened? And the answer is no. And to show you how the role of these, as Professor Olavini said, is political violence, how serious this is, there's now a move by the Rwanda Tribunal to send these prisoners for trial to their enemies in Rwanda, the RPF regime, and to make them serve their sentences in Rwanda. It would be akin to handing over President Milosevic to the KLA, to handing him directly over to Agnew Chakwe. That's what they want to do. The UN says it's neutral, but in fact, it is now planning to deliver these men over to their enemies in Rwanda, this military dictatorship. And Professor Philip Rentjens, who is a very famous man at the University of Antwerp, and who is an expert on the Great Lakes region of Africa, and was a prosecution witness for many years, and who wrote a letter just 1 month ago saying, as of the ICTY, he now refused to cooperate with the ICTR anymore because of his policy of selective prosecution and the fact that they can't end their trials, and therefore has been withdrawing his services with them, has stated that if they're sent back to Rwanda, they'll be dead within 1 year. Every one of these prisoners will be dead because they are the entire former regime and intellectual, and they represent the intellectual class of Hutus in Rwanda. So the UN, which says it's neutral, is using this tribunal to not only demonize and condemn this former leadership and allow the United States and bring the control of Central Africa through this proxy regime in Rwanda. They're going further than that and further than the ICTY. They are now going to hand these men back over to the invading army which attacked them in the first place. And can you imagine what you would feel if you found out today that they're going to hand over Milosevic, if he's convicted, they're going to hand him over directly to the KLA? What would you think? And that's exactly what they're going to do. And I wouldn't be surprised if something like that happens to President Milosevic. If Kosovo is broken off and joins Albania, I wouldn't be surprised if he has to serve his sentence in Greater Albania. And how long would he last there? So, the personal experience remarks from if you speak to Ramsey or any other lawyers, being a fan, Misha, if he could be here to tell you about what's going on in the Milosevic trial, is they're more than Kafkaesque. It's hard to explain the horror of what's really going on. The prisoners know they're condemned. They're intelligent men and women. And I have one quote I'd like to. They wrote a long letter to the Secretary General of the Security Council complaining about them being sent back to their death sentence in Rwanda. I can find the passage from that here. There are a long letter which I'll read to you. I have it up here. Do you read it? I can't remember. It doesn't matter. But they're basically saying that if these tribunals were just tribunals, then the UN tribunal would not want to send them to Rwanda. They would send them to places where they've already agreed to be sent, which is France, Mali, Italy, but no one would want to send them back to Rwanda. So the only thing I can say is that sometimes most of us who've done trials, they wonder why we're there, because in one way we make the tribunal look legitimate by being there, so they can say they have defense counsel. And we all actually agreed to withdraw en masse so they would not be able to claim that. The prisoners
asked us to stay, despite that ethical problem. And they said, that may be true, but on the other hand, if we don't have you people here, the world will never know the true story of what happened in Rwanda. We'll never know what we really do. And our only hope is to have you, and hope to get some truth out. So we ask you to stay. So we have. But it's very difficult, and it doesn't sit easy with the conscience to sit there and take part in trials which we know are unfair and can't possibly be fair.